Welcome to the Estate Planning Project. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. Our purpose with this project is public education on a wide range of estate planning topics. With a growing aging population, unprecedented wealth transfer from one generation to the next, and the dramatic rise in estate litigation, the need for estate public education has never been greater. This is a technology-based project that will produce podcasts, articles, and blog posts. As a social collaborative initiative, experts such as lawyers, estate planners, and financial planners will share their thoughts and ideas on a bottomless pit of estate planning topics. This project offers general information only and is not a substitute for seeking personalized professional advice. And our guest expert today is Dennis Nerland, QC. And Dennis is one of the three founding partners at the law firm of Shay Nerland, based in Calgary, Alberta. Dennis leads their tax and estate planning practice. Today's podcast topic is called Trust: Best Practices in the New Estate Planning Paradigm. Welcome, Dennis, and thank you for joining our project.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I would like to remind everyone as I speak that I am a lawyer, licensed to practice in the province of Alberta, sort of practicing here in Calgary, but that the concepts I'm sharing certainly are known to lawyers across the country, and if you have any specific questions that you'd like to ask of sort of local counsel, they will in all likelihood be able to share some wisdom and insight with you on the matters I'm going to talk about today.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for adding that point. And I do have a series of questions, so let's get started with the first one. I'd like to ask, what is a trust?
That's a very good question. In fact, it's a difficult question. It's a very actually difficult task when you're trying to define what a trust is, because it really isn't anything at all. And I'll tell you a story to sort of punctuate that. But if you ask 100% of the men and women on the street anywhere on the planet, they really won't have a very precise idea of what a trust is. You ask 100% of the civil law lawyers practicing on the planet, they won't know what a trust is because it's a concept only known to common law. And if you ask the common law lawyers what a trust is, 60% will answer that it's a vessel to hold assets. That would be partly right, but not completely right. 30% would say it's a tax vehicle. That would be partly right, but not entirely correct. And then 10% wouldn't be really sure beyond responding that it's a relationship, and that's actually closer to the truth, but again, not completely correct. It's really ecclesiastical conscience, and I'll tell you a story just to punctuate that point. The easiest way to think about what a trust is to first rule out what it isn't. So it's not a company, it's not a partnership, it's not a foundation, it's not an agency, it's not a joint venture, it's not a contract, it's not a legal entity at all, because trusts don't have any separate legal personality, nor do they have a separate legal life. And there are a lot of joint ventures and contracts and other types of vehicles sort of parading around out there with the name trust on them that actually aren't trusts at all. And so let's get to the what is a trust. Now we've ruled out what isn't a trust. It has its, as I mentioned, it has its roots in ecclesiastical conscience. And it really began, in sort of ancient Roman times, but it never really began for purposes of common law until from the time of the 11th and 12th century Crusades. So after William the Conqueror became the king in 1066, so the so-called Norman invasion, there was one common law of England that was created. At the same time, he nationalized all the land and used that land as currency to sort of basically run the country, and developed a feudal system out of the land holdings. The common law courts that were created regarded the land as one indivisible entity, just copying the way it had been under Roman law, because William was from France. And during the Crusades, a problem developed. So we had the feudal system. So he would sort of pay people by giving them an interest in land, and then they would get the serfs to work the land, and then there was this economy that developed around that. But when the Crusades came, these landowners who went to fight would transfer their title to their land to a person that they trusted, so that the feudal services could continue to be performed and received, and their family could be looked after, and so on and so forth. But when they returned, they found that the people they entrusted sometimes refused to transfer title to their deed back. So they would then go to the common law courts. The common law courts really had no way to divide title, and so the sort of the bad guy in this whole equation would, in the eyes of the law, would maintain sort of ownership of the property. So that started to create a bunch of discontent. And so the king had a pretty good idea. What he did is he tapped the Lord Chancellor, who was head of the Church of England, actually, on the shoulder, and they discussed the problem. And what they did is establish the courts of chancery, which the Lord Chancellor would run. And these are sometimes referred to these days as the courts of equity, and in these days they've actually merged with the common law, so there's only one law. What the Lord Chancellor would do in cases like this, when to have the Lord Chancellor hear the case, the Lord Chancellor would then examine the situation, and where it appeared to him unfair to let someone with legal title hold on to the land, he would then declare that the real owner in equity, so in all fairness, was the knight, only if this is what good conscience dictated. And that's why I say that a trust is that relationship which is determined by the courts of chancery, in the sense that the true benefit of the property didn't belong to the person on title, but it actually was held by the person on title for the benefit of the knight in the example I posited. So that's why I say it has its roots in ecclesiastical conscience. It's not a legal vehicle. It's really a relationship between, in the courts of chancery's eyes, the legal title holder and then the true beneficiary of the property. And so that is what a trust is. If I can summarize it the way that is currently understood under our laws today, I mean, it has certainly developed. The notion of this ecclesiastical conscience has developed over the last 1,000 years, a very flexible sort of notion. But the contemporary thought is that there are really, it's a relationship among someone called a settlor who has property, who then gifts that property to the trustee, so the sort of the rogue in my previous example, who holds it for the benefit of the beneficiary, who is the knight in the example that I had posited. And the beneficiaries have what are called fiduciary rights to enforce the benefits of the property in their favor. The trustees have fiduciary obligations to the beneficiaries, and the property or assets which are held by the trustee for the benefit of the beneficiaries are ring-fenced. And what that means is they don't show up on the trustee's balance sheet, nor do they show up on the beneficiary's balance sheet if it's a discretionary trust, only in the case if it's a non-discretionary trust. Those are distinctions I'll make later. But the assets are ring-fenced. They're actually held in a type of suspended animation. And that is what a trust is.
Well, thank you for that detailed explanation, and especially the historical perspective. That's very interesting for people to hear. My next question is, what are the benefits of a trust, and why are they commonly used?
Trusts have been around, as I had indicated, for about 1,000 years. So there's a 1,000 years of well-defined rules in place which define rights and obligations and what a trust is. The hallmark of what a trust is, and it's fascinating, is that it's capable of being adaptable to any societal circumstances. So as times have changed over the years, the notion of what a trust can do and what it can't do, the rules of in the courts of equity have actually been very flexible, and they change over time to adapt to changing societal circumstances. So that's extremely important aspects of a trust, is that it's almost like a Darwinian creature that's totally adaptable to its circumstances. So it's been around for 1,000 years, which is much longer than any other, if you're thinking of a legal entity, which has strict rules and conditions attached to it. Those usually last a few hundred years. But this has been around for 1,000 years, and because it's been adapting and it's capable of continuing to adapt, because we don't have strict codification, it'll continue to adapt, and I suggest be around for another 1,000 years. When you speak to lawyers in the legal community who practice in the trust area or in the estate planning area, especially in Britain, they're very proud of this creation. It comes, you know, from the time of William the Conqueror. Well, they'll tell you, and we all say that it's a vessel which provides for superior governance of assets. Because the assets are held in a suspended animation in a discretionary trust, we would posit that they actually provide the best protection of assets of any creation out there. They're super flexible, adaptable in the manner I've described. Private documents, so there's no public trust registry, so there's the maximum confidentiality you can hope for. And then in particular circumstances in Canada or in Britain or in the United States, they provide tax advantages. Those are the high-level reasons for why they're commonly used.
And my next question is, what are some examples of today's common uses of trust?
There are quite a number of examples, so I'll share maybe half a dozen. As I've mentioned, the assets are ring-fenced, so they're actually a very good vehicle to utilize to protect assets against the vagaries of the external world, so against creditors and failed marriages and so on and so forth. And also, the assets can be ring-fenced. It also can be used to protect assets against what I would call financially irresponsible family members. That's a type of trust called a spendthrift trust. So if someone in the family were to get, you know, a large gift, and the giftor was worried about it being squandered and perhaps wrecking, you know, the family member's life in the process, you know, a trust governance structure can be set up to guard against that. There are a number of interesting income tax strategies where taxes can be deferred. So, for example, in an estate freeze, where a trust is a popular vehicle to facilitate that. Again, it's a useful vehicle to protect against estate taxes. So a simple example of that would be, you know, Canadian owning U.S. property would be subject to, depending on the map, it would be potentially subject to U.S. estate taxes. If it's held in a special residence trust, those U.S. estate taxes would not be exigible of death. Other common uses would include health, education, maintenance and support trusts for minor and dependent children in the event that, you know, pass away early, or health, education, maintenance and support for a spouse and children if you pass away and leaving a surviving spouse and children. They are utilized in jurisdictions where there are high probate fees or complicated probate processes to avoid the probate process because the assets aren't on the decedent's balance sheet. Again, getting back to the ring fencing notion, when the decedent passes, at that point in time when probate would normally apply to the assets, it can't apply to the assets because the assets have already been passed. They're held in the suspended animation process in the trust. They're used because they're a private, sort of confidential arrangement, whereas probate is public. If there's a suspected or an anticipated family fight, or, you know, in some complex families, there can be fights after death. If the assets are carved up in private arrangements and trusts, that mitigates against those fights. They can act as a proxy for a prenuptial agreement because the assets are moved off the soon-to-be-married person's balance sheet. And if you talk to the British common law lawyers in terms of international structuring, they'll say it's the best. They'll tell you that in systems, you know, like in London or in Jersey or in Guernsey or wherever, that it's the best governance system to protect wealth confidentially, flexibly, and with the least amount of sort of global tax. Those would be sophisticated international trusts. So that summarizes some of the common uses that trusts are known for today.
Well, that's interesting, and I'll give you a personal example. When our family took out a trust, and it was when my mother-in-law was having mental health issues, we were very afraid that this predator was coming and visited her every day, brought her food, and was trying to persuade her to sign over her condo to him. And my husband was very afraid of this, and we went to our lawyer, and our lawyer said, oh, this is a red flag. This is bad news. And so with our lawyer's help, they put my mother-in-law's condo in trust, which meant that man couldn't get his hands on it.
Yeah, no, perfect.
Interesting part of that story is we were thinking this is what was going on. And after the paperwork was done and back from the lawyer, my husband left the documentation on my mother-in-law's countertop, and the man never showed up again.
Every family has to
be aware that, as you said, these are wonderful, flexible documents. And when we went to our lawyer with the problem, we didn't know how he was going to solve it. That's his job to do. And his solution was a trust. And so there's just one other example that I can relate to on how wonderful these tools are and how important it is for lay people like me that when we're stuck with a problem, go find a lawyer. The lawyer will have the answer. And it's just wonderful peace of mind. So thank you, Dennis, for all of those explanations.
Okay. Well, my pleasure. Yeah, that's a good solution to the problem. I mean, that's a great example.
And not believable at first, but it worked and mission accomplished, and the man never got his hands on her condo. So we were very thankful for the lawyer's help. My next question is, what is the most important consideration in establishing a trust?
Interesting question. If I had to single out the most important consideration, I would say, or significant choice in the menu of options when you're creating a trust, I would say it's the choice of trustee. If you get the right trustee, there's huge value. And on the downside, if you get the wrong one, you actually risk wrecking the beneficiaries, wrecking the family. The universe of choices for trustees, the usual suspects are family members, friends, business associates, professional advisors, and then professional, some of them are professional trustees, and then institutions, you know, the trust companies. That's the universe of choices. I would say the key point to look for is that an excellent trustee demonstrates what I call excellent qualities. They don't guarantee results, but the best trustees will guarantee best process, which maximizes the probability of getting good results. The qualities to look for are in a trustee who's going to have a long-standing position guarding assets for beneficiaries, let's say your kids over time. He gets all the evidence and is inquisitive, so acts a bit like the Lord Chancellor, exercises good judgment, knows a conflict when they see it. Trustees are prohibited from self-dealing, so they, you know, if I'm a trustee, I can't direct the money if I'm an institution to my accounts and actually profit by the fact that I'm a trustee. So if I have a competing interests and I know there's a conflict, stay away from them. And that's where most of the lawsuits come from, or when trustees don't see conflicts and they get into trouble, the beneficiaries wake up and find out trustee's been profiting from the relationship without disclosing it. Making the hard decisions, empathetic, very good at tax, finance, and accounting, a good communicator, respected in the business community, understand the family and understand the beneficiary's needs, and inquisitive enough to actually communicate and figure those out. Know what they don't know, so they'll hire advisors. They'll hire lawyers, accountants, investment advisors, and so on and so forth when they need to. If I had to isolate the top three characteristics, I'd say good judgment, solid executive functions, and stamina, because it's a tough job. and stamina is very important. That would be the most important consideration, because the trustee is where all the power's at, and that's where all the obligations are, and it's a difficult position, so it's not to be taken lightly. So get the right one, and you're going to have actually a very good result with the trust. Get the wrong one, and you can have a disaster. So that's why I say it's the most important decision.
And my next question is, what is the most common mistake advisors and clients make in designing and operating trusts?
The lack of critical thinking. If you think back to what a trust really is, it's a relationship, not a legal vehicle. So, you know, conventional thinking out there is that, and it really comes from our Income Tax Act, because our Income Tax Act superimposes a legal fiction on a trust, so it looks at and treats a trust like it's a separate legal entity. And so in that world, where it is a separate legal entity, the trustees become, if you want to use the company analogy, the trustees would become directors, the beneficiaries would become shareholders, and then the trust would pay tax. Now, the trust is deemed to be a separate legal entity, but only for tax purposes. The problem comes when, you know, you're not looking at the trust through the tax lens, you're looking at the trust for commercial purposes. So going back to your story, it wasn't a separate legal vehicle that was created. It was actually the assets were moved into a trust and off your mother-in-law's balance sheet, and therefore no longer accessible. So they weren't really anywhere landing in anybody's balance sheet. But the way to properly think about a trust is that the legal and fiduciary obligations of the beneficiary have ring-fenced the assets for the benefit of the trustee, have ring-fenced the assets for the benefit of the beneficiary. And a very simple example is we had a financial institution in our office. They had a series of RSP trusts, and these RSP trusts were being attacked by Revenue Canada, or CRA, they're probably more currently known, on the basis that there should have been withholding tax in respect of certain foreign property. The argument, and a successful argument, was that in fact, so when you step back, and if you just accept the fact that RSP trusts, because they are called trusts, and you read the document, you think it's a trust, had they actually been trusts, that was the correct approach. But what we were able to establish is that it was actually that the classical hallmarks of a trust weren't met. So there was no trust in the first place. Was the RSP trust was really nothing more than a contract. If you can remember what I said before, what a trust is not, and one of the examples was, it's not a contract. And therefore, the provisions of the Tax Act that the CRA was attempting to enforce couldn't be enforced against the trust, because it really wasn't a trust in the first place. And so that's just a simple example of sort of a convoluted situation you can get into. And if you think about, if you never lose, if advisors and clients or users of trust think about trust in the classical notion of really being this concept of fairness, a relationship rooted in ecclesiastical conscience, where the assets are held in suspended animation, where they're ring-fenced, that's the proper way to think about a trust. If you lose sight of that, start thinking of it as a legal vehicle, all sorts of bad results or incorrect results can happen.
Thank you for that answer. And my next question is, what are the generally accepted practices in the current trustscape?
So we're going to get into the kind of the heart of a trust and what the trustees are supposed to do. And this is 1,000 years of law that I'll summarize in the next minute or two. But the principal focus under the current governance standards is on the financial relationship between the trustee and the beneficiary. The last 1,000 years has punctuated this. This is where trustees have got into trouble and the rules have been formed. So the focus is on the legal function, on the administrative function, on the investment function, and on, you know, the tax efficiency function. And what's missing is that the human relationship, so the relationship between the trustee and the beneficiary, is incidental, and the focus is on the financial. So you've got the focus on the financial, and the human side of the trust is incidental. This is just the way it is, because the last 1,000 years, the problems have all been financial, and the focus has been for trustees to live up to best practices, to focus on what are called the four duties, the duty of loyalty, the duty of impartiality, duty of prudence, and the duty to protect the trust property. So I'll just talk a bit about each of those. They all have a financial focus. So what is the duty of loyalty? This is the duty where the duty of the trustee to act in good faith. If you remember, the ecclesiastical conscience was there was bad faith of the person who took the land from the knight. And there's also is the duty to avoid any self-dealing or conflict. I talked a bit about that in my last question the answer to the last question. The duty of impartiality is the duty of the trustee to act with an even hand. If there's more than one beneficiary, they have to be treated fairly, and one cannot be preferred to the other. So if you have a trust where you have, say it's a spousal trust, where the spouse is entitled to income and capital during his or her lifetime, and the children entitled to the capital after, or maybe it's only income before death and then the kids get the capital. In investing the portfolio, there has to be a balance between capital appreciation and income. One, you know, the income beneficiary can't be preferred to the capital and vice versa. That's the duty of impartiality. And the duty of prudence is, this is the big one, is that the trustee is to invest, administer, and report is what the courts say, and actually some statutes now, say a reasonably prudent person would. And what exactly does that mean? Something called the prudent investor rule. And the trustee must, in administering and investing the trust assets, is charged with the duty to analyze risk and return, so think of both, diversify the assets to manage risk, balance income and growth to protect against inflation, but in an impartial manner so as not to prefer one class of beneficiaries to the other, the duty not to pay unnecessary fees and transaction costs, so pay really good close attention to the investment advisors and what they're charging. Delegate decisions. If you're not a professional investor, hire one and prepare an investor policy statement. And to think on an after-tax basis. Taxes are a cost, probably the largest cost, and so trustees are charged with the duty to pay as little tax as legally possible. And if they don't, the beneficiaries will have a valid claim against them. And then the last duty is the duty to protect the trust property, and that is more or less self-explanatory. Again, notice in all these duties that there's very little focus on the relational issues. The focus is firmly on the financial. So it's financial first, relational is incidental.
Which brings me to my next question. Why a new trustscape?
That's a good question. Why a new trustscape? Think about a trust. They can do a lot of good. They can also do a lot of harm. Trustees are right now focused on process, financial process. They're focused on the duties of loyalty, impartiality, prudence, and protection of the trust property. They're a lot of times focused on not making mistakes, not getting sued, so playing defense in my terminology. So why is all that? And my thesis is that the problem really lies in prioritizing the financial relationship over the human relationship. I would say the solution lies in reprioritizing the relational over the financial. I'll just tell you a little story. If we think back to the late 1800s and we think about two families with the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts, both extremely wealthy first generation wealth families. As a matter of fact, I think each family roughly 10% of the U.S. Treasury, so incredible wealth. Both families had access to the best lawyers, accountants, investment advisors, so on and so forth. So the best financial advice, the best structuring advice out there. And they both built complicated financial structures that were, blue chip, best of class. That's where the Vanderbilts kind of stopped. They kept focusing on the financial. The Rockefellers created governance structures, brought in coaches and mentors, focused on financial literacy, focused on the next, the succeeding generations, focused on human relationships. Fast forward to today, I think the Vanderbilt's empire disappeared about 20 or 25 years ago. I mean, Anderson Cooper's part of that family. They ended up suing each other. They destroyed all the wealth, whereas the Rockefellers are still a cohesive, very wealthy, fourth or fifth generation family with a robust governance structure. Trusts are an integral part of that, both of those stories. But the Rockefellers understood and prioritized the human the human part, whereas the Vanderbilts didn't, and with the consequent results. So that's why I say the problem, the solution lies in reprioritizing the relational over the financial.
And my next question is, what leading edge practices do you expect to see adapted over the next 10 years or so as this new trustscape develops?
Current best practices would have, you know, a trustee with a portfolio, let's, for example, being invested for the benefit of the beneficiaries, or say there's quite a bit of money in it. So the trustee would have a tax committee who reports to the trustee and would have policies, because he has the duty to think on an after-tax basis. It would also have investment policy statements and an investment committee, and usually that's where it ends, if you remember the duties. I mean, I think as far as the last 1,000 years of common law and the duties and the focus, that's good enough. That works. He just executes the administrative and legal functions on top of those, the investments and sort of tax advice. But in the future, best practices I see would be to establish a distribution policy and a committee that would actually dig into the family and understand their needs and so on and so forth, and also and have maybe a committee that reports to the trustee, and then also a beneficiary committee who's focused on developing the beneficiaries as fine, upstanding citizens. The best practices for the new trustscape, the traditional duties I talked about, the four duties, those I think become table stakes. Those don't get denigrated at all. The current bar of excellent processes around all the financial matters cannot be actually, you know, lowered. It has to stay at its same, you know, high level and even get raised. But there's a new higher bar of excellent processes around relational matters, which I call fiduciary character. These fiduciary characters would be the way the new trustscape for best practices for trustees in the future. And what are those? The first would be do no harm. That's the first principle of any noble profession. So really it's the Hippocratic Oath for trustees. The next fiduciary character on the relational side would be that of fidelity, which rests on the solidity of the character of the trustee. You know, the trustee stands by his or her word. Trustee makes good decisions and rings true when tested, because beneficiaries test trustees, and operates at what I call the highest bar of integrity. You might ask, what's the highest bar of integrity? Well, I refer to three bars of integrity. First bar is doing, you know, your perception of reality and what's right and wrong. So doing what's right all the time based on your perception of the facts and the evidence and so on and so forth. The next bar is a higher bar, and that's doing what you say, so walking the talk, as it were. And then the third bar is telling the kind truth. It's the level of integrity that a lot of people struggle with, but it's telling people, and in this case the beneficiaries, what they need to hear. It's the kind truth. It's compassionate, but it's absolutely honest and authentic, and it's meant to individuate the beneficiaries. And that's what I mean by operating at the highest bar of integrity, is always doing the right thing, following through and doing what you say, and then you're caring about the beneficiaries and developing them, individuating them, telling them the kind truth. The next fiduciary character would be that of regency. The regent rules while the young monarch comes to maturity. In a lot of cases, that's exactly what a trust is like. The trustee would then manage the trust in such a way that at the end of the day, the trust could hand over the assets to the beneficiaries, and they would be just fine. In the same way, the regent's ultimate goal is to educate the beneficiaries and look after the kingdom, so that at one point, when the young monarch is ready, he has the wisdom and the assets have been protected. You merge those two, and he runs the kingdom just fine. That's actually not a bad analogy, the relationship between a trustee and a beneficiary. And then there's the fiduciary character of discernment. And this is the judicial function of the trust. This is where the trustee gets the opportunity to be the Lord Chancellor, get the evidence, decide wisely, don't do the unconscionable, do what's fair in the circumstances, that sort of thing. And the last one, and it's probably the most difficult, is courage. It's really easy for trustees to swamp individuation of the beneficiaries just by writing distribution checks. It takes courage to say no but, and then show a way forward that doesn't depend on the money. And in a funny sort of way, courage is infectious. It helps the, it actually, when the trustee's not taking the easy way, which is to write checks, but taking the hard way, which means he cares about the beneficiaries, and he's operating at the third bar of integrity and telling them the kind truth and not swamping them with money when that's the easiest thing to do. But that sort of courage helps the beneficiaries find courage within themselves to continue to grow and to individuate into great citizens.
Well, thank you for that explanation. And my last question for you today, Dennis, is what are the best practices for trustees and beneficiaries in meetings?
Again, let's take a look at the example of where there's property, a business, a large portfolio, it's in a trust, we have beneficiaries, you have the trustee, perhaps the parents have passed away, maybe they haven't, it doesn't really matter. But communication is the secret to making these things work, and having a formal meeting process is the way to do it. There have been a number of studies in a number of research centers in the United States and Canada, universities, where they say, so you want to maximize the probability of success in succession planning. So you want to avoid the shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves and three generations problem. There's really three things that have to happen. Number one, have regular meetings. Number two, have agendas for the meetings, take minutes, keep to-do lists, and then have accountability sessions to follow up on the to-do list. And then the last thing is involve someone independent, so that would be, you know, the independent trustee. These are business, so if we just focus on the meetings for a second, they're business meetings, so treat and respect them as such. So I talked about agendas and to-dos and accountability, do it that way. Have an agenda, agree on it ahead of a time, plan enough time to move through the agenda comfortably so it's not rushed. Don't meet in restaurants, like have a private setting, make it a professional setting, a boardroom somewhere. Take minutes, absolutely take minutes, prepare lists out of those, create accountability scorecards. And then I would say the top two rules for these meetings would be number one, prepare, and number two, see rule number one. And then the last thing is and it's really important for both the beneficiaries and the trustees to schedule social time, have dinner after, as soon as the formal part's done, when the business is completed, because this is where you really get to know each other. This is where comfort and trust is built, and without trust, you won't have a successful trust.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for answering all of my questions. As we begin to wrap up, Dennis, could you please share your contact information with our audience, please?
You can reach me, direct line is 403-299-9605, cell number is 403-828-9605, and my email, I'll share as well, is dnerland@shaynerland.com. You can find our firm on the website, all my contact details are on there, so if you just Google Shay Nerland, which is the name of our firm, it'll come up at the top of the list, at least hopefully. And you go into the website, you'll find me and all kind of my history and contact details are there.
Wonderful, and thank you for that, Dennis. We wish to thank you for joining our project, and we encourage our podcast audience to listen to everything that you've said today and to learn from you. You can follow our project at www.caregivingmatters.ca. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.